is intrinsic versus extrinsic points of view. And actually, it might be better to call it mostly intrinsic versus mostly extrinsic points of view. Or an even better title is half integral for quantum gravity, not, which is why I can't wear the t-shirt. Here's a problem. Imagine you have a squirrel or a mole or something that has a place where it sleeps, and then sort of around that a sort of donut-shaped space where it eats, and it has three paths from here to here, and then another three paths up to the surface. Okay, so this is where it sleeps, it eats, and then here's the surface, the ground. And the question is, how many paths are there from here to the outside world? So the reason I mentioned this problem is because I thought it might delight you to know that this was set as a problem for my grade 3-year-old daughter at school. So they're already teaching path integral techniques here in Waterloo in grade 3. Neil, in response to the abstract I sent, maybe you can persuade us that we should adopt a different technique rather than the path integral technique. And I'll try, but what chance do I have when already they're indoctrinating 8-year-olds, my own daughter, in fact, in these techniques. So Raphael wrote a nice paper about 20 years ago called something like Forks in the Path. Forks in the Road on the Path to Quantum Gravity, is that it? And one of the forks is what kind of approach to quantum theory you take. And actually, he was very careful. He said there are many approaches, but the two he singled out in this fork would be the Hamiltonian approach, where you evolve a wave function in time, and the path integral approach. And then he gives various arguments in favor of taking this approach instead of this approach. And one of the things that's nice about the path integral approach is that the objects here are space-time objects, rather than having objects that live at a given time. Here you have objects which are really fully space-time objects, and so that's more in the spirit of relativity theory. So we could imagine, so that's great, but imagine if you're trying to ask a question about something more mundane. So in honor of this homework assignment, let's imagine there's a squirrel. And call him Alfred, because I want it to be a particular squirrel. And I'm interested in the question, did Alfred wake up this morning and have nuts for breakfast and then go for a stroll? Okay. This is... So in the path integral technique, what you need to do there is you need to consider all the histories right from the very beginning of the universe. Okay, so various different theories for the Big Bang and formation, whatever happens down here. And some of them will go through here. And in this history, you'll find a squirrel who looks like Alfred, who did indeed have nuts for breakfast, then go for a stroll on a day that you can identify for whatever reasons, because of some internal structure in this history, as the 15th of November, 2017 AD. And of course, there are many such paths that go through here. And then there are also many paths that don't. And some of these paths, the world didn't even form. Or evolution didn't happen and so on. So there were no squirrels, certainly no squirrel called Alfred. So if you want to talk about this very local event that might or might not have happened this morning, then you have to use an object, a mathematical object, which is the collection of amplitudes for this squirrel. Etc. In which amplitudes in which Alfred did eat nuts and go for a stroll. And this is, of course, a very long list of amplitudes. And the reason you need this mathematical object is because if you want to consider other questions, like whether Alfred subsequently climbed a tree and collected some more nuts for the breakfast the following morning, then you'll need to look in these histories at which of those are further compatible with there's subsequent things you're interested in. So you really need this mathematical object to work.
Sets of histories come in different levels of coarse graining.
Right.
Right. So are you suggesting we have to have a fine-grained description all the way back to the beginning of the universe?
Oh, no. So sure, you could still be interested in... you could have coarse graining and sort of just be interested in stuff that happened since the beginning of the year.
Trainings that describe Alfred.
Yeah. But even so, you're going to be interested in some more structure than the particular question that you're interested in. So the point is...
you mean later Alfred is going to be interested in
something else. Yeah. So most of this structure is extrinsic. To the question that you're interested in.
Yeah, right. Good.
Even if you adopt some coarse graining, still you're going to have, for the particular question, this particular question is about Alfred, most of the structure is going to be extrinsic.
Sorry, when you say extrinsic, you mean in the past? Or?
Oh, future, past, everything. Just not about Alfred eating nuts and going for a stroll, or even not just about Alfred eating nuts, going for a stroll, climbing a tree and getting more nuts.
But do you need to know something that... happens in Andromeda galaxy in order to...
Well, then it depends, like Jim says, on the level of coarse graining. But in any case, you're going to have to know about more than just the questions you're asking. Yes, Martin.
There is also local extrinsic, which is that they have to be trees to have nuts on them.
Right,
so
yeah.
So that's the context in which these intrinsic questions have to be placed.
Yes.
However you ask the question, mm-hmm. if you're trying to be as intrinsic as possible, mm-hmm. you need some structure around to contextualize that question.
Right, right.
Whether you use all of the universe or whether you use the existence of a forest.
Right.
That's a matter of course. So.
Right, yeah. Sure, that's true. So in any case, all of this is a way to say, wouldn't it be nice... if if we could proceed in a way that was more intrinsic, so mostly intrinsic, so we have Alfred and nuts and so on, and we want to associate with this some mathematical object which is more intrinsic to the particular questions we're asking. So the question is, can we do that kind of thing? Well, let me show you, because I should keep my eye on the time. There's another question is, which is, did the participants of this conference get to have lunch today? And that's increasingly in doubt. So let me show you a way you can proceed just in quantum theory. So this is quantum theory with circuits. And one question you might be interested in is, so imagine you have some preparation, call it A, and some measurement, let's call it B. So we have, we're interested in what's the probability for this situation. Incidentally, it's a slightly more general notion of preparation here. There may be, you're interested in the preparation that happens when the red light on this box flashes. And here you're interested in the measurement result when the blue light on this box flashes. So we're interested in the joint probability for those lights flashing. Well, in quantum theory, that's given by the trace of some operator associated with A times some operator associated with B. And we can write that down instead if we modify our notation. Like so, where now we put a label on here which indicates that we're taking the trace. Okay, the trace is just a bilinear product, and we can just write it like that instead. And then we can draw this diagrammatically, like so. Call this system A. And so we see that we have a diagram, a calculation here represented by a diagram that's exactly the same as the diagram for the thing it's a calculation for. Do you have a question?
Yeah, just this one is saying if one of the, if the trace, shouldn't there be a loop from the top of A around back to the bottom, from the top of B around back to the bottom of A?
I mean, it's just a matter of notation. I'm writing...
We use assume two indices in one.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is I've assumed two indices in one. Yeah. You would.
I would prefer to write.
Yeah, the but then these diagrams get very messy. Whereas this way, they look exactly like the thing that it's a description for. So these operators act on Hilbert spaces that are associated with the indices. Okay. So this is nice because you get the same picture. But this also works for any circuit, and I'm not going to go into the details of how to set this up. But imagine if you have a circuit like this. And there should incidentally be arrows on here. You can show that the probability for this circuit is given by a calculation that looks exactly the same, has the same structure. But these are now operators. And now when you have one of these wires, it indicates taking the partial trace over some appropriate part of the Hilbert space. I'm not going to give you the details. So I call this the operator tensor. Formulation. Because you take these operators and then you give them some indices, so they have a sort of tensor type structure. And this point of view isn't really, it isn't the Hamiltonian point of view, and it isn't the path integral point of view. It is, in some sense, a third point of view. Furthermore, the object that you associate so each of these operations has a mathematical object, an operator associated with it. And this mathematical object is mostly an intrinsic object.
Are these more complicated? In terms of traces?
Yes, in terms of partial traces, yeah. Yeah.
Partial?
Yeah, so every time there's a wire, it means you have a partial trace.
But that means just in terms of projectors that are larger? That is, there were sort of one on some subset.
Yeah, so
but if
think
you
of
have them ordered, A, B. So, but now we go from A to R, okay.
Yeah, so.
Then is it followed by two of them or something?
I don't understand. Sorry. I mean, I'm not. I didn't want to give all this formalism here.
Oh, I see.
But you can do this. It gives you standard quantum theory for circuits. So the reason I said it's mostly an intrinsic object is because if you actually want to determine what this is equal to, what this state is equal to, the way you would do it is you would take the operation, and then you'd put various measurements on these outputs. And if you go over enough different measurements on each of these outputs, then you can determine what that operator is equal to. Okay, it's a sort of linear process. So these measurements are extrinsic to the place itself, but they're only just outside. And it's interesting, actually, that in quantum theory, you can do this with local measurements on each of the legs that come out. You don't need to do entangled measurements. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that in quantum theory, you use complex numbers. If you have quantum theory restricted to the real numbers, then it doesn't work. That's another story. One thing you can do in this cases is demand physicality. So what I mean by physicality is, first of all, that probabilities are between 0 and 1. So whenever you calculate a probability by this technique, you always get a number which is between 0 and 1. And secondly, that there are no influences back in time. And interestingly, it's sufficient to impose two conditions on these operators to ensure that you have physicality. And the two conditions are that this operator associated with any of these operations has to have if you take the partial transpose of just the input part of the operator of the Hilbert space, then the operator you get must be positive. Okay, so this is just a mathematical condition. And let me put some. There's another mathematical condition which says that if you take the output and you ignore it, which is basically taking the trace over the output or contracting with the identity operator, then the thing you get has to be less than or equal to the identity operator over the input. So these two mathematical conditions are sufficient, necessary and sufficient to guarantee that you have physicality. What's also interesting is that it's possible to arrange, to instantiate any operator that satisfies this condition. So it's possible to physically set up any operation corresponding to any operator that satisfies these conditions. It's also interesting that these conditions are time asymmetric. See, this condition here is true in singles out one direction over the other. So this is a time asymmetric condition. Thank you. You can use these kinds of circuits to set up a sort of model.
Just a quick question about your notion of time.
Yep.
You only mean that sort of A causes B causes C. You're not saying there's a global time.
Okay, so these circuits.
Everything outside this diagram.
These circuits are always taken to be directed acyclic graphs. Okay, so again, there's no closed loops. That does mean that you can always foliate these graphs into a sequence of hypersurfaces.
In a number of ways?
Generically in many different ways. And well, the thing is, this way of doing the calculation doesn't use the foliation.
So when you say there's a time, when you talk about time, you just mean the arrows.
And the fact that you also have a directly acyclic graph, which means you can give it the interpretation of time.
Yeah. So I'm not sure I understand. So in this example with the ABCD, is B before C or after?
So the arrows in this case indicate time direction.
So A goes directly to C, but also to B and then C.
That's right, yeah.
So C is after A and after B.
That's right. If you want to think in those terms, yeah. Yeah. So you can use this as a sort of model for space-time. So we can imagine we have some vast circuit and so on. Every time these things cross, we have one of the circles, so there's an operation there. And this could continue on down into the past, and then go on into the future. Now, we might only be interested in some questions that pertain to a small part of this circuit. So we might only be interested in, actually use a different color chalk. Yep.
That's a causal set with a set of maps between open spaces on top of it. Is that right?
I think that's right, yeah. I mean, the...
So that's the structure that needs to be called the final causal history.
I mean, I'm slightly worried because here I'm using these are operators that act on a Hilbert space. So the objects that live on each of these vertices are operators acting on a Hilbert space.
Right, but implicitly the Hilbert spaces are there.
And Hilbert spaces live on each wire. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So this kind of object has a long history, yeah, sort of mathematically certainly, and also being used in various places in quantum gravity. This approach ties it to the operational formulation of quantum theory. So this is equivalent to the condition that transformations are completely positive, and this to the condition, this is the condition that they're traced non-increasing. So imagine if we're interested in some part of this. So this part, for example. Well, what you can do is you can look at all the operators that live on the vertices and calculate an operator here. You have some indices. For some particular set of outcomes on these operations, on these vertices. Or you may be interested in the operator that's associated with a different set of outcomes. So I should say, I've calculated this operator by taking the partial trace over all the wires inside this region. Okay, so get this operator, or if I'm interested in a different set of outcomes, outcomes prime, then I get this operator. And then we might be interested in the relative frequency between having this set of outcomes or this set of outcomes. Okay, that's a question we can ask. What is the relative frequency of seeing this set of outcomes or this one? And this is a very intrinsic question because I'm not talking about what happens outside, only about what happens here. Okay, well, how do we do that? Well, the way we do it is a two-stage calculation. The first stage in the calculation is to say, well, is it even a well-defined question as to what the relative frequency is? And it's only a well-defined question if it doesn't matter what's done outside this region. And the condition for that to be true is that this operator is parallel to this operator.
But if one were to come before the other in influence...
So these operators pertain to the same region of this circuit. So it's just two operators calculated for different sets of outcomes on these vertices. And we're interested in the relative frequency. So it could be, you know, some version of squirrel eats nuts versus squirrel eats acorns, or whatever. Okay, so if these two operators are proportional, then the relative frequency of this versus this doesn't depend on what's done outside. That's the first stage. And then the second stage is that the relative frequency is equal to the constant of proportionality. So you need this two-stage calculation to answer these kinds of questions. But it does enable you to answer questions about, you know, arbitrary regions of this space-time. And of course, not all the questions have an answer. Incidentally, if these operators aren't exactly parallel, you can still put some bounds on the relative frequency.
So while it may be true that you don't want it to depend on things outside, those particular outcomes could depend on the specific parts of that region, right? So some, depending on what, you know, that you eat certain kinds of nuts is something that's in the causal pass
right.
of that region. And depending on that particular thing, certain outcomes will be preferred over certain other outcomes.
So if just to simplify it, we sort of stop thinking about squirrels for the moment and think about quantum transformations and quantum operations and so on. So and these could be, all of these could be some kinds of qubits. Okay.
Right,
but the thing is now, if these two operators are parallel, then the relative probability doesn't depend on stuff that was done before.
That sounds like a very, very strong. Yes,
that's what... I think that's often people's response to that, is that this is a strong requirement. But I would claim this is actually all you can do in physics, that every calculation you do is like that. Now, one special case of this would be where you had two closed circuits, then there'd be no indices, you just have real numbers. And of course, those numbers are proportional to each other. But it's nice, and that's the situation people normally calculate for when you've got control of everything. But using this technique, you can go into situations where you wouldn't normally do a calculation and still have conditions. So it's more general than the usual way of thinking.
Can I get you 5 minutes more?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, so that's page 3. There's also page 3.5. I'll cut the short talk. Cut the talk short, of course. So let me just make a few points about this kind of approach. So it's operational. We're interested in settings, you know, knob settings and outcomes. It's intrinsic. We only talk about the region of interest. We can calculate operators for the region of interest. I think intrinsic, it's mostly intrinsic. If you actually want to determine what these operators are equal to, you need to do this tomographic locality. No foliation is used in doing these calculations. So it's not a Hamiltonian style calculation. You do have space-time objects. So these objects have some sort of space-time aspect to them.
But you said it could be foliated.
It can be foliated, but it's not...
There are many equivalent foliations.
Yeah, but you don't use the foliation in doing the calculation. So whereas in the Hamiltonian formulation, you need the foliation to be able to do the calculation.
But they're supposed to be equivalent.
Well, they're supposed to be equivalent, but then why would you use it? It's sort of much nicer if you can have this sort of manifest invariance. You build a picture out of what happens for a bigger region out of what happens out of lots of smaller regions. So, for example, I could be interested in, what happens here. So this is you know, another question and some more questions. And I can take the operators associated with each of these regions and plug them together using by taking the partial trace over the wires where they join. Another point to make, because this is not usually the case, certainly in this community, is that these objects are linear in probability. If you want to do so, if you do tomography, if you calculate a set of probabilities corresponding to these measurements, and you get these probabilities, then that set of probabilities can be used in a linear fashion to calculate these operators. Whereas normally people use amplitudes. Okay, so there's lots of places in the literature where this kind of approach is taken, as Lee mentioned, and sort of this looking at arbitrary regions, according to Raphael, it goes back to Dirac. More recently, Robert Urkel has pursued this kind of approach, general boundary formulation. And then there's quantum foundations groups, so a group in Pavia, Mara Dariano and collaborators who've looked at this, a group in Vienna who are looking at that. Actually, Czaslaw Bruckner, who's the leader of that group, is giving a talk today at Perimeter, which you can't go to because it clashes with this workshop. And Yakir Aharonov has his multi-time formulation, which is closely related to this sort of way of thinking. So what I don't have time to talk about, so I won't talk about it, is the following. is how to take this sort of perspective and see if we can use it for addressing the problem of quantum gravity. So the questions are there: what are the operations? What are the settings? What are the wires? What are the outcomes? What do those things correspond to in a theory of quantum gravity? And as a first step, you can do this in classical general relativity. So I have a paper that's on the archive that you can look at there. But you can take this sort of calculus and apply it to general relativity. In the case of standard general relativity, the most natural thing to do is to have a possibilistic calculus instead of a probabilistic calculus. So there you're trying to calculate whether certain operationally defined configurations are possible or not. Page 5, 6, 7, 8. And you end up getting diagrams which are very similar to the diagrams here. Although incidentally, the arrows in that case are conventional, and you don't have they're not associated with a notion of time direction. And so these graphs also don't have to be directed acyclic graphs. And the reason for that is that if you're interested in looking at different configurations of your underlying solutions, then you have different metrics over those different solutions, and so you can't force these arrows to correspond to a time direction in a natural way. So I've tried to sketch what is a sort of third approach lies between the Hamiltonian and path integral approach. It's not completely unfamiliar to this community, but maybe it's less familiar in this sort of framework, which comes from operational quantum theory, where your objects are linear in probabilities. Stop there. I mean, I think if you can write down local field equations, then on a manifold, then you can do it. I don't know. I'd have to look at each situation.
I think it's worth trying.
Yeah.
Thank you, see you again.